Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Atlanta, Georgia for a State of the Science Summit on breast cancer. In keeping up with the expanding breast cancer treatment armamentarium, we sat down with Jane L. Mizell, MD, an assistant professor in the Department of Hematology and Medical Oncology and Department of Gynecology and Obstetrics at Winship Cancer Institute, Emory University School of Medicine, and Aditya Bardia, MD, MPH, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and an attending physician in medical oncology at Massachusetts General Hospital. In our discussion, Drs. Mizell and Bardia shed light on treatment considerations for women with triple-negative breast cancer who do not achieve a complete response to neoadjuvant therapy, emerging treatment strategies for patients with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, as well as the optimal timing of genomic testing in women with progressive hormone receptor-positive disease. First, we hear from Dr. Bardia, who presents a case of a 40-year-old premenopausal patient who was found to have a hypoechoic mass in the right upper quadrant, approximately 4 centimeters in size. Listen on to hear the complete case presentation from Dr. Bardia.
So 40-year-old premenopausal African-American female noticed presence of a lump around her right breast. Physical examination revealed presence of a vague mass in the right upper quadrant of the breast. There were no lymph nodes clinically palpable. She then had a mammogram which revealed presence of ill-defined borders in the right upper quadrant with associated calcifications that were concerning for malignancy. She then had a breast ultrasound which revealed presence of a hypoechoic mass in the right upper quadrant, approximately 4 centimeters in size. Then underwent an ultrasound-guided core biopsy, which revealed presence of infiltrating, poorly differentiated grade 3 adenocarcinoma. Estrogen and progesterone receptor testing were negative, less than 1%, and HER2 was negative as well, with an IHC of 2+ and a FISH ratio of 1.6 and a copy number of less than 4. So maybe I'll start with the first question. In this young 40-year-old premenopausal African-American female with a new diagnosis of what looks like triple negative breast cancer, what would you recommend as the next step? And in terms of systemic therapy, would you consider neoadjuvant chemo, or would you consider upfront surgery followed by adjuvant chemotherapy? If you could guide us on your decision-making process.
Sure. I think, you know, particularly the fact that this woman is young, the fact that she's got triple negative disease, I would have a low threshold to treat her with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. I think, you know, there have been lots of studies showing that whether you give the chemotherapy up front versus whether you give the chemotherapy afterwards, it doesn't change the efficacy of that regimen. But for patients who have tumors that are, you know, particularly larger than 2 centimeter, like a T2 tumor, and now even for some of the larger T1s, we know that there is prognostic information to be gained by whether or not they respond to that chemo neoadjuvantly. And now we have options for what to do if they don't have a complete response. So if you're able to sort of melt away the entire tumor with a neoadjuvant regimen, and then at the time of surgery they have no cancer left, you know that their chances of recurrence are relatively low, and then you can likely omit further systemic chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting. Whereas if you were to treat this woman neoadjuvantly and she were to not have a great response, then you would know that she would be a candidate potentially for capecitabine, as we saw with the CREATE-X regimen, improving outcomes for triple-negative patients with residual disease, or for a clinical trial. For example, there's an ECOG trial looking at capecitabine versus carboplatin in the adjuvant setting for patients who don't get neoadjuvant carboplatin. And then there are also trials looking at a year of pembrolizumab in the adjuvant setting for patients with triple-negative disease. So I would probably err on the side of neoadjuvant chemo here, just because I think there's information to be gained prognostically from how she responds, and then potentially because there's information to be gained from you know, how well she does if we give her additional adjuvant systemic therapy.
Yeah, makes sense. in this patient to consider neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And I think increasingly the preference is to consider neoadjuvant chemo or adjuvant chemo in a patient who otherwise needs chemotherapy.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of information to be gained from that. And in addition, with someone who's young like this, it also gives you time to do genetic testing if that's something that's of interest. We didn't, in this question, STEM talk mm-hmm. about whether she has a strong family history, but, you know, 40-year-old woman, especially with a triple-negative cancer, you would think about potentially BRCA1 being implicated. And that might change some of the options for surgery. She might opt more towards bilateral mastectomy if she were BRCA mutated, and then it might influence your chances of potentially thinking about incorporating carboplatin if she were BRCA1 positive, particularly if she didn't have a great response to the AC, if you were to give AC first as part of your neoadjuvant regimen. So I think giving the chemotherapy first also allows you time for genetic testing to come back to help you make decisions about surgery and other things.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. This makes a lot of sense. And you bring up a very good point about the germline BRCA testing. And with the approval of PARP inhibitors in metastatic disease, I think there's also emerging interest in utilizing PARP inhibitors as neoadjuvant therapy. Recently had a nice publication by Jennifer Litton and her group demonstrating that a number of patients can actually have a very nice response with single agent neoadjuvant PARP inhibitor. So I think in the future, we might be using more of PARP inhibitors for germline BRCA mutant breast cancers.
Yeah, no, we actually have the follow-up to that study, which is the NeoTALA study open here at Emory. And mm-hmm. I've had a few patients who I've actually done the germline testing as part of the screening for that trial. They do, mm-hmm. as part of the study, a pretty quick test just for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. And I've had two patients who have screened and actually screen failed because then they were not BRCA positive. But it's an interesting study, and it brings up a lot of questions. You know, I think if for women who get to a PCR with 6 months of neoadjuvant PARP inhibitor, it's amazing, but it also is still that remaining question for those women of, do we still need to give them more chemotherapy afterwards, and if so, how much? But I think it definitely represents an amazing step forward and potentially could allow some women to get away chemotherapy free.
Yeah, and I guess that's a good problem to have if you get a PCR
exactly.
With single agent therapy. So how about patients who do not have germline BRCA mutations and have triple negative breast cancer? What's your preferred regimen in terms of neoadjuvant chemotherapy?
Yeah, I tend to give dose-dense AC followed by weekly Taxol. I like the weekly Taxol better than the dose-dense Taxol just from a clinician standpoint. I find that it's easier to monitor patients, particularly for neuropathy, and to dose reduce a little bit institute therapy for neuropathy if they develop it. It just seems to be easier to get mm-hmm. them through it. And I typically don't add carboplatin unless they have not a great response to the AC or unless they're BRCA positive. I don't add carboplatin to the neoadjuvant paclitaxel. As a matter of course. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of controversy around that, but would be curious about your approach to that too.
Yeah, in general, I tend to use ACT as well. I think it's a regimen that we have a lot of expertise in terms of managing the side effects and the number of patients who require dose reductions or dose interruption is relatively not frequent. As opposed to using Taxol with carboplatin, where a number of patients do require dose interruptions and reductions. And in the neoadjuvant setting, sometimes that tends to create a lot of anxiety about not giving the systemic treatment or holding the systemic treatment that's targeting the cancer that's still intact. So I completely agree that ACT is a very good regimen that can be utilized in this setting. And carboplatin could be saved for patients who are either at very high risk or patients who do not have a very good response to ACT. So I'm completely in line with the approach that you've outlined.
Yeah, there are a couple, there's situations I was going to say where if patient can't get anthracyclines for whatever reason, where of course you can use TC. There's also a phase 2 trial, maybe even a couple of phase 2 trials looking at carboplatin with a taxane for 6 cycles, much like what we do for ovarian cancer. And there is a reasonable PCR rate with that as well. So I think that would be the exception, but I would save those for patients who you want to give the anthracycline to but can't for whatever reason in terms of usually concomitant cardiac disease.
Mm-hmm. So it's nice to have a non-anthracycline-based option.
Exactly.
Let's say the patient received neoadjuvant ACT followed by surgery, and her surgical pathology revealed residual tumor, specifically YPT1N0 disease. What would you recommend next?
So I think in this case, you know, she's had a reasonable response. She was a T2. You've gotten her down to a T1, but the cancer is still not gone. And so we know from the trials that this is a patient who, assuming she's tolerated the chemo relatively well and is open to doing more therapy, given her young age, you would probably want to offer her more therapy. I think you have a couple of options here. Certainly adjuvant capecitabine for 24 weeks, as the CREATEX study looked at, does improve outcomes, for patients with triple-negative disease who've got residual. I think other options for this patient would include clinical trials, depending on where she's being treated and how convenient it is for her to accommodate a clinical trial into her life. The capecitabine versus carboplatin study that I had mentioned that ECOG is running, or the adjuvant pembrolizumab study would both be options for this patient. There are probably others depending on where she is geographically. I think one of the things that comes up in just sort of real-world management of these patients is that patients get tired. I mean, ACT is not a joke, and then surgery and radiation, it's all a lot to kind of recover from and incorporate into your life, particularly if you're young and working and maybe raising kids or caring for elderly parents or, the variety of things that people in their 40s are doing. So I think I always find that it's useful to introduce to patients up front that, we're going to give this neoadjuvant chemo. You're going to need surgery, you're going to need radiation, and depending on your response, there may be more we can do to improve your outcome, just so you aren't kind of blindsiding people who think they're kind of quote-unquote done with the fact that they, in fact, would benefit strongly and that you would recommend more treatment. But this is someone for whom I would want to give more treatment if they could tolerate it, just because I think they stand to gain from that and are probably a little bit high risk if you do nothing.
Yeah, I would have a similar approach. I think you brought up a very good point, which is to set up the expectations up front when you're talking about neoadjuvant ACT at that time, mentioning that if there's not complete response at the time of surgery, we could consider additional therapy, particularly oral capecitabine in this setting. So the patients are prepared up front in terms of what's coming after surgery. And the options at this time include oral capecitabine versus a clinical trial. And I think this area is an area where we need additional clinical trials, both with better therapies, because we know that oral capecitabine is not the best therapy for triple negative breast cancer, as well as more genotype or biomarker guided approaches, so that we can salvage patients who do not have a good response to neoadjuvant ACT and potentially improve the cure rates of patients.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And I think hopefully, if some of those trials are being done and are going to be done in the future. And I think as we get more used to this approach, we as oncologists will get better about having these conversations. I think, in the HER2 positive setting now with the Catherine data having changed a little bit of what we do adjuvantly for patients who don't have a response to neoadjuvant therapy, we're also having that conversation with many patients that the adjuvant approach may change based on your response to this treatment. And I think, we're having that conversation, although it's a little bit of a different conversation in the triple negative setting. So I think, with all of this, the more you can prepare your patients, the better. And I completely agree. Adjuvant capecitabine is not the end of this story. And I think as these trials report out, we will get more information about which patients benefit most from which post neoadjuvant regimen, and then we'll be able to better tailor things for success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the beginning of the story of adjuvant therapy that's actually guided by response to neoadjuvant therapy.
Yeah, exactly.
1 year later, the patient noticed an increase in shortness of breath, which prompted restaging scans, which revealed pulmonary and liver lesions. A CT-guided biopsy revealed breast adenocarcinoma that was estrogen receptor negative, progesterone receptor negative, and HER2 negative. How would you treat this patient? Is there any additional diagnostic testing that you would recommend?
This, of course, is what you fear. Metastatic disease, metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, we know the outcomes are not likely to be great. I think genomic testing at this point is definitely something that I would do frontline, and the recent approval of atezolizumab and Abraxane together for patients who are PD-L1 positive in immune cells kind of highlights the need to do that and to do that quickly, because it does change really your first line therapy options. And now for these patients who are PD-L1 immune cell positive, first line atezo-Abraxane we know improves progression-free as well as overall survival. I think genomic testing may also help identify other clinical trial options for this patient, depending on where they live and how relevant a trial option is for them from a lifestyle standpoint at this point. I think realistically, some of these patients, when they present with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, they're symptomatic, as this woman sounds to be, with shortness of breath and new pulmonary and liver lesions. She may or may not perceive she has the time to think about trials, and if she does, that's great, and if she doesn't, then I think atezolizumab and Abraxane would be a great choice if she is PD-L1 positive. If she's not, and if she can't do a clinical trial, I think single agent chemotherapy is probably reasonable. Or if you're looking to get a response quickly, and she's got a lot of visceral disease, gemcitabine and carboplatin is always a good option. I like that option in particular in someone who's got metastatic progression kind of reasonably soon after dose-dense ACT and capecitabine, just because those would be two options that this patient hasn't seen before, that work well together, don't cause a lot of hair loss or neuropathy, and tend to be well-tolerated. So I think those would be some of the things I would consider initially.
Yeah, my preference would be the same. At this time, there are two additional tests that one could consider. One would be PD-1 testing to see if the patient is a candidate for immunotherapy with atezo, as well as germline BRCA testing if that's not been done. And potentially would be reasonable to consider genomic testing as well in case the patient is eligible for one of the genotype-directed clinical trials. But outside of trials, my preference would be to consider a platinum in this patient who's not received a platinum in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting.
What is your feeling on platinum alone versus platinum with a partner, and which partner's drug do you typically use?
Yeah, in general, we tend to use platinum as monotherapy, and in part, it's guided by a clinical trial that was done here where patients received carboplatin as a single agent, and some of the patients did very well. I'm not entirely convinced that the gemcitabine necessarily adds much to the carboplatin, but does impact the counts, particularly platelets, resulting in thrombocytopenia. But if there's a clinical trial which requires carboplatin plus gemcitabine as the preferred chemotherapy backbone, I wouldn't have a problem with that. But outside of a trial, in general, I prefer carboplatin.
Got it.
And then, and looks like this patient ultimately did receive carboplatin, and the carboplatin worked for 6 months, followed by oral capecitabine, which worked for about 4 months or so, and then the patient had disease progression, a scenario that we increasingly see in triple negative breast cancer, where with standard chemotherapy agent, the median progression-free survival is in the range of 4 to 6 months. So the question would be what next to consider as far as third line therapy is concerned and any clinical trials that you're excited about?
Yeah, no, it's a tough situation and definitely does reflect a lot of what we often see in the real world. I think, as we said in the last question stem, testing for BRCA and testing for immunotherapy responsiveness with PD-L1 would still be helpful in this setting if that hasn't happened yet. Because I think even though the approval for atezo-Abraxane, that trial was first line, I definitely would use it in later lines if you were to discover PD-L1 positivity. So atezo-Abraxane, I suppose, could be considered now if that patient emerged as a candidate. And similarly with PARP inhibitors, I think talazoparib or olaparib would be a reasonable option if she's BRCA mutated or if there's genomic testing suggesting even responsiveness to PARP inhibitors because of other genomic measures of instability. I think the sacituzumab govitecan data is very exciting, and so a trial involving that drug might be a good option if she's got that available to her. And other trials, even some of the immunotherapy plus PARP inhibitor trials, might be an option for a triple negative breast cancer patient, even if she doesn't necessarily have markers making her seem like a slam dunk for either of those options by themselves. If she's still in good shape and is motivated, I probably would consider doing broader genomic testing like a Foundation One panel or one of the in-house panels if she's at a larger cancer center at this point, just to sort of cast a wider net for targetable alterations. And then if there's nothing else that can be done from a trial standpoint or in terms of targeted therapy, I suppose you could think about reusing a taxane at this point. I've certainly used eribulin in this setting, kind of heavily pretreated patients. Those would be some of the things I would think about. And I've also used nabaldine in this setting, and for patients who kind of want something gentler but aren't ready quite yet to say they don't want further therapy.
Yeah. And from a patient perspective, sometimes a few months could make a difference. Recently met with a patient who had received 5 lines of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting. And we had a discussion about hospice, where the patient mentioned that, you know, even if I have a few more months, that's important for me because I have my son's graduation coming up. And I think it's very reasonable to discuss various treatment options, even if a patient has had disease progression on 3 or 4 lines of therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think all of it depends on performance status and patient preference, because in this setting, it really is about, you know, helping people live as well as possible and as long as possible. I think everyone has a different threshold for kind of how much they're willing to put in order to gain a little more time.
Next, we hear from Dr. Mizell, who presents a case of a 38-year-old female who was diagnosed with a grade 2, 2.6 centimeter T2N0 estrogen receptor positive breast cancer in 2013. ER and PR were 100%. The patient received a lumpectomy and radiation followed by tamoxifen. Due to adverse events, the patient stopped treatment. 5 years later, she developed bone pain and was found to have osseous metastases and liver metastases. A biopsy of the metastatic liver lesion is HR positive and HER2 negative. Listen on to hear the complete case presentation from Dr. Mizell.
So the next case is a 38-year-old female who's diagnosed with a T2N0 ER positive breast cancer back in 2013. At the time, it was 2.6 centimeters. It was grade 2, ER 100% positive, PR 100% positive, and HER2 negative. On the pathology report, there was no lymphovascular invasion. She had 5 lymph nodes removed that were all negative, and she had an oncotype score done, and that was 14. She chose not to pursue chemotherapy at that time, but had a lumpectomy and radiation, and started tamoxifen in October of 2013. She took it for 3 years until October of 2016, but then stopped because of side effects. And then a year later, in October 2017, she developed bone pain and was found to have osseous metastases as well as liver metastases. She had a liver biopsy done that revealed grade 2 invasive ductal carcinoma, ER 85% positive, strongly so, PR 35% positive, again, strong staining, and HER2 negative. So she initiates therapy with Lupron, tamoxifen, and denosumab in December of 2017. Switches to palbociclib and letrozole once ovaries are fully suppressed around March of 2018, and has a great initial response, but then in June 2019 has scans that show 2 new liver lesions, a moderate pleural effusion, and stable bone disease. The pleural fluid is drained and is consistent with ER-positive, PR-positive breast cancer.
What regimen would you choose for her now? If she had a longer interval of response to letrozole and palbociclib, would this change your recommendation?
Mm-hmm. I would address the first question. In terms of therapeutic options, now we have multiple therapeutic options in the second line setting for hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer. The options include fulvestrant with without a CDK4/6 inhibitor, exemestane, or potentially even fulvestrant with everolimus, or chemotherapy options such as oral capecitabine. And I think all of these are very reasonable options for patients with hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer, including this patient. And ultimately, it boils down to discussing the various advantages, disadvantages of these options. There are some patients who prefer to continue endocrine therapy. There are others who like a different approach. This patient has received tamoxifen, letrozole, Ibrance, and I can see from a patient perspective the interest in considering a different therapy such as oral capecitabine before considering endocrine therapy alone. So it's good to have multiple options, and ultimately it depends on the patient preference as well as reviewing the advantages, disadvantages of different approaches. Now, coming back to your second question in terms of if the patient had longer interval of response to letrozole Ibrance, would that change the recommendation? I think it partly would guide the recommendation and personally would make me lean more towards an endocrine therapy approach, because the longer response to letrozole Ibrance would suggest that this is potentially an endocrine-sensitive tumor. And continuation of endocrine therapy-based approach, such as fulvestrant with without a CDK4/6 inhibitor, rather than chemotherapy in this setting, could work for this patient and save chemotherapy for late lines of therapy. Now, whether to consider fulvestrant alone or fulvestrant with a CDK4/6 inhibitor, be it palbociclib or ribociclib or abemaciclib, that's a open question at this time, and there are clinical trials such as PACE, which are looking into this question of continued CDK4/6 blockade with fulvestrant in a patient who had disease progression on an aromatase inhibitor with a CDK4/6 inhibitor. One can argue that continued CDK4/6 blockade is a concept that we've used in other settings, such as HER2 blockade with trastuzumab. On the other hand, this is a different setting. Hormone receptor positive breast cancer is not the same as HER2 positive disease. CDK4/6 inhibitors can be associated with significant toxicity, such as myelosuppression, serious AEs, such as pulmonary embolism, pneumonitis. And I think this is something that needs to be addressed in a clinical trial setting. I don't think that we have the answer in terms of giving continued CDK4/6 blockade to all the patients would help. I don't know, Dr. Meisel, what's your approach?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think a lot of it depends on how well they tolerate the letrozole and palbociclib, and then also how long they respond to therapy. And then also what the nature of the progression is, whether it's subtle or something where, you know, cancer sort of seems to be exploding in different and new places and causing symptoms. Because again, if they've responded longer to the endocrine-based therapy and, you know, if they progress and progress more subtly, then it suggests that they're still endocrine sensitive and likely to be a better candidate for some of the continuation endocrine therapies, whether that be exemestane everolimus or a Faslodex fulvestrant by itself, or fulvestrant plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor, which I think is a challenging space. We have the PACE trial open, mm-hmm. and I always try to enroll patients in that trial if I can. But I do get a lot of referrals in from the community where you can certainly switch the endocrine backbone and continue the CDK4/6 inhibitor without a lot of trouble from insurance. And so I think a lot of people nationwide are doing that. It'll be good to get that question answered in clinical trials, and I'm glad these trials are being done now, because I think if people had waited longer to do these studies, then it may have been harder to get them done. It is That's challenging. True. I mean, I think the CDK4/6 inhibitors are a phenomenal class of drugs, but they do require laboratory monitoring. They don't come without side effects. So for some patients, if they have, say a 2 or 3 year run on letrozole and palbociclib, I might be more inclined to consider a single agent if they didn't have a genomic test suggesting that they would benefit from adding something like alpelisib, and we'll probably get to that. I think this woman definitely has options, and a lot of what we decide to do, whether it be fulvestrant, exemestane everolimus, genomic testing, or potentially thinking about oral chemotherapy like capecitabine, it would be kind of a matter of pros and cons and what her preferences are, what side effects make a difference to her in terms of quality of life. Just kind of that approach of this is a chronic disease. We want to help you live as well as you can and as long as you can. And what living well means is going to be different for every patient.
Mm-hmm. And you brought up a good point about alpelisib, because that's now FDA approved in the second line and beyond setting for PIK3CA mutant hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer.
Right. And so I think that in some ways, for many of us, has pushed genomic testing closer to upfront. For women with metastatic ER-positive breast cancer. These are women who, before that, I was not testing right away after progression on letrozole plus palbociclib, because there were lots of clinical trial options and other standard options that I could use in that setting if I wanted to, and there still are. But I think knowing whether or not they're an alpelisib candidate becomes more clinically relevant now. Although I will say, I think the alpelisib is a challenging drug in some ways to manage. I've seen patients have a harder time handling the side effects from that drug in some situations than they do with other drugs, such as capecitabine or everolimus. So I think when you embark upon therapy with that, it's important to kind of make sure patients are aware of the hyperglycemia, the diarrhea, the things they could experience on the drug, and make sure you manage that proactively.
When would you do genomic testing? Would you test the original liver specimen, or do you need a new sample post-progression?
Yeah, personally, I'm a big fan of tumor genotyping. We just reviewed that now we have data that it could potentially guide the use of an FDA-approved agent in this setting. And if you look at the approval of alpelisib, the FDA essentially allowed both tissue as well as plasma testing for PIK3CA mutation analysis. I think besides the advantage of helping select a drug, tumor genotyping also provides insight into the tumor biology, which can help understand tumor evolution. And that can sometimes also help in selection of endocrine therapy. For example, if based on tumor genotyping, ESR1 mutation or mutation in the estrogen receptor is discovered, that would suggest that the tumor is estrogen independent and potentially resistant to aromatase inhibitor. And in such a patient, I would lean towards the use of an agent that targets the estrogen receptor directly, such as fulvestrant. And because ESR1 mutations are acquired mutations, these are mutations that could be missed by profiling the primary tumor, but could be picked up by profiling either the metastatic disease or plasma-based genotyping. So my personal preference in general is to consider plasma-based genotyping or genotyping of the metastatic specimen when possible. But if for some reason, if that's not feasible or it's tough to get the metastatic specimen, then I think it's reasonable to consider profiling of the primary tumor, at least for truncal mutations like PIK3CA. The final advantage of using genomic testing is that it can also provide some insight into the mechanisms of resistance. For example, in a patient who's received CDK4/6 inhibitor, if you're seeing emergence of acquired RB1 mutations, that would highlight that this tumor is likely resistant to CDK4/6 inhibitor, and potentially continued use of CDK4/6 inhibitor might not be advantageous.
Yeah, and I think there's so many different ways to go about this, and I completely agree. I think the ability to use the liquid biopsy is such a nice thing, both for patients, because it doesn't require a solid biopsy, which can often be challenging to schedule and difficult to tolerate. They just go for a simple blood draw. But it also offers kind of insight into sort of what is happening with the tumor overall, as opposed to just one specific biopsiable site. And I love the idea that now with the emergence of ESR1 mutations in patients on aromatase inhibitors, or the emergence of RB1 mutations in patients on CDK4/6 inhibitors, we're able to get kind of more of a picture in real time of how patients' cancers are responding to the therapies we're giving, and then what they might respond to next in terms of thinking of a next line of therapy. I've also had situations where patients have had, response in the bone, but then have progression in the liver. And those are situations where I would sort of take the extra step and really push towards getting another solid biopsy of a metastatic site, just because if there's one site that's kind of not behaving, I like to know what's driving that. I have had situations in a patient with ER-positive breast cancer where a HER2-positive clone has emerged, and then that opens up new options for therapy that we wouldn't have thought about in the past if we hadn't kind of done a repeat biopsy and thought a little bit more about that. So I do think these are some powerful tools, and learning more about how to use them in the individual setting will help us guide management for each of our patients.
Great. So what trials are exciting to you in this setting? What trials would this sort of a patient be eligible for?
A lot of trials. This is a crowded space. I think CDK4/6 inhibitors have essentially established themselves as the preferred first-line therapy for ER-positive metastatic breast cancer. But the post-CDK4/6 setting, or the second-line and beyond setting, is a setting where there are a number of clinical trials asking various questions related to both sequencing as well as new drugs. Broadly, I think they can be categorized into three broad categories. The first is trials that are investigating the role of continued CDK4/6 blockade. We reviewed the PACE trial, which essentially is looking at the question of continued CDK4/6 blockade in a patient who has disease progression on first-line CDK4/6 inhibitor. The second would be the role of combination therapy with other agents in a patient who's had disease progression on CDK4/6 inhibitor. Can you continue CDK4/6 inhibitor but add a third agent? And I think this potentially is a strategy for tumors that have a mixed response, where you have some lesions where the disease is under control, but there are a couple of spots that are growing. Maybe with the addition of a third inhibitor, you could control that. And Trinity is a clinical trial that was designed to address this question of adding everolimus to CDK4/6 inhibitor plus endocrine therapy. And then finally, I think this is a setting where novel drugs are being evaluated. Oral SERDs, an example being the Emerald trial, which is evaluating oral elacestrant versus endocrine therapy in this setting, as well as novel antibody drug conjugates such as sacituzumab, govitecan, or trastuzumab deruxtecan. I think this is a setting where potentially one can investigate novel agents.
Yeah, and I think you covered that beautifully. There are a lot of different options for this patient. I think which options to choose probably as an investigator depends a little bit on the nature of her progression, how long she spent on first-line therapy, and then, of course, what's available and open at a site that's convenient to her. I do agree this is a patient who I would love to get on a research study if possible, just because she's such a great candidate, and there's so much to learn about what to do in this second-line setting. So any of these options would be great. I am really excited about the idea of oral SERDs that are potentially more potent than fulvestrant, because fulvestrant represents such an exciting and well-tolerated option for many women. But if we could get rid of the injections and make that more potent, we would, I think, really be succeeding in a lot of ways. So there's a lot to be excited about here, I think, and some of the trials that are open now and actively enrolling will really help inform us as we move forward into the future.
When would you pull the trigger on chemotherapy?
Yeah, in general, we tend to save chemotherapy once the endocrine therapy options have been exhausted. That's the general guiding principle. For an individual, I think it's a much more complex decision. As we reviewed earlier, we need to consider various factors, including patient preference, the duration of response to prior therapy, the tumor biology, and whether patient has visceral involvement and the need for urgency of a response. If a patient has multiple liver lesions and you need a quick response, sometimes we tend to use chemotherapy even before all the endocrine therapy options have been exhausted. And the final point I would make is that all chemotherapy agents are not the same. It's much easier to pull the trigger on oral chemotherapy such as capecitabine or gentle chemotherapy such as navalbine, which in general tends to be well tolerated and does not cause alopecia, as opposed to other intravenous chemotherapy agents that can result in side effects such as peripheral neuropathy or alopecia.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with all of that. I think there are situations where patients have progressed with very dramatic initial diagnoses of ER-positive metastatic breast cancer, where I've used a single-agent chemotherapy to kind of consolidate them and help them respond quickly, and then initiated letrozole and palbociclib. And in several instances that I can remember offhand, I have had patients who then stay on sort of first-line endocrine therapy after chemo induction for a very long time, and that's been a wonderful thing to witness. In terms of patients going from multiple lines of endocrine therapy to chemo, I agree it tends to be often once they've sort of either progressed on multiple lines of endocrine therapy or if they're showing signs of kind of endocrine resistance, it seems like it's going to be hard to surmount with the addition of a targeted agent. And there are definitely situations where patients, you know, might tolerate an oral chemotherapy such as capecitabine potentially better than a drug like alpelisib. And so, you know, as Dr. Bardia said, not all chemotherapy is created alike, and we definitely have to take that into account when we think about these patients. I think we're very lucky in this setting to have a lot more options than we did even several years ago, and many more options rapidly coming to market.
Yeah, more and more, at least metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer is becoming like a chronic disease with all the various options. You can really push the survival curves.
Yeah, no, and I think that comes with, you know, issues of its own in some ways, just for patients who, you know, people keep asking them, you know, when are you going to be done with treatment? And the answer is often, you know, I'm doing so well, like I'm continuing to work and live my life, but I'm not going to be done. Like, this is forever. And metastatic, you know, metastatic disease of any kind carries a certain, you know, it's a difficult thing to talk about. And I think that's something we also are now sort of forced to help our patients with. And it's a good problem to have, but also a challenging one. You're thinking about these diseases as truly chronic and something that you can manage well over time.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you would like to learn about the treatment landscape of ovarian cancer, consider registering for the October 24th State of the Science Summit in Columbus, Ohio. We will also be heading back to Atlanta, Georgia on November 4th to host a State of the Science Summit on Hematologic Malignancies. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.